TED Audio Collective.
Hi, I'm Debbie Millman. Canva is great for designing visual content for work, no matter what industry or department you work in. Nail your next presentation with Canva Presentations. Start with a professionally designed template and use it as a springboard for your design. It's a serious time saver. Time to present but can't be there in person? Enter Canva Talking Presentations. Record yourself presenting and add your talking head to your slides so your audience can watch your perfected presentation anywhere, anytime. Start designing today at canva.com. Designed for work.
This message comes from Apple Card. Earn up to 3% daily cash back on every purchase, every day. Then grow it at 4.50% annual percentage yield when you open a savings account with Apple Card. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card subject to credit approval. Savings available to Apple Card owners subject to eligibility. Savings accounts provided by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, member FDIC. Terms apply.
You don't know if the thing's going to be any good. You're in the, I don't know, it's like being in the middle of like preparing a thing that's like not done, and you don't know if you're going to finish it on time, and you don't have enough time, and you're like, for me, fear is just built into making things.
This is Design Matters with Debbie Millman. On this episode, Debbie talks with Ira Glass about his career in radio and podcasting and about the making of This American Life.
Like, weirdly, the part of it that I like the least, and I feel like I can do it competently, but I've never been fond of it, is the actual performing on the radio part.
The interview was conducted in front of a live audience at the On Air Fest in Brooklyn, Sunday, March 8th, 2020.
Okay.
I discovered a 1991 article in the Chicago Tribune titled, "Take It Off," with the following description. After deciding to shed his long hair look, a brave dude tries a variety of cuts on the way up. I'd like to show you this image from the paper and ask if it is indeed you, the brave dude.
Yes. I can confirm that is me.
Share the backstory with us, if you can, just for a few minutes.
It was a really long time ago, and for a while I had a ponytail, which at the time seemed cool.
So that went up there, or was
it? It didn't look like that. It was longer than that.
Very Steven Seagal.
It wasn't quite so Steven Seagal. It was a little messier. It's not a very dramatic story, but at some point I decided I just wanted to change how I looked because I wanted to change my life at that point. There's some old saying that when a woman cuts her hair, she changes her life.
Really?
I heard it in a movie anyway. And I didn't know the saying at the time, but it was true. And then somebody knew somebody who's like, oh, we could take pictures of that for the newspaper, something that had never happened to me before. I had never been photographed for a newspaper. At the time, I was a freelance reporter for NPR. And I thought, okay, that'll be a new experience. Okay, I'll try that. And that's how it ended up in the paper. It's not very dramatic, I'm afraid.
I think the one right above you is rather dapper.
That short hair like that, it did look like that for a while when I was working at NPR in Washington. Like through my 20s, I started at NPR when I was 19. And did kind of all the low-level jobs on sort of like on All Things Considered, a morning edition. But I looked very, very young, and I was younger than most of the staff. And so in my early 20s, I just thought like I need to figure out a tactic to seem like an adult. And so I wore a tie every day, and it sort of worked. Like I looked so young for so long. I remember when I was in my early 30s. I was reporting in Lincoln Park High School, and I would get stopped for a hall pass. I'd have to know I'm an adult. So,
you've said that you don't like interviewing famous people.
that mostly because they arrive at an interview with a mask that might be hard to penetrate. When that happens, do you have any surefire way to get them to lower the mask?
I mean, honestly, I've interviewed so few famous people that I haven't really had to think my way through that problem. I know you interview lots of famous people. I mean, I think that in general, finding an anecdote or a way in that people haven't talked about before, for example, an article from 1991 that a person hasn't thought about in a long time. Totally, I respect the technique. I think the people who are so good at that, you know, Terry Gross, there's a print reporter in Los Angeles who used to write a lot for the LA Times, but also for Entertainment Weekly and stuff, named Margie Rock. And she and I used to talk about this because she would interview like Nicole Kidman and people like that. And I'd just be like, what do you do? And she would tell a lot of stories about herself, like that would relate to things inside them, and were just enormously empathetic as a person. And they would just get lost in a conversation with her, as lost as somebody can get, who's in that kind of position. And she would get all sorts of things from them that were very personal and very real. I think in general, like, I mean, I said this a million times, but an interview is a party that you are throwing. And if you are a three-dimensional person, it gives the other person the opportunity to be a three-dimensional person back. And so that's just an enormously powerful force. I remember when I was interviewed by Marc Maron for the WTF podcast, he is so emotionally present and so bare that you just feel like you have to rise to the occasion as the interviewee.
You were born in Baltimore. You recently had a birthday. Happy birthday.
Sure.
Your parents met at a swimming pool. They met at a swimming pool when they were teenagers. They were married for nearly 50 years.
Yeah.
Your mom was a clinical psychologist. Your dad started out as a radio announcer, but then eventually became a certified public accountant. Have you heard any of his early radio announcements?
I have. Yeah. He stopped being on the radio when he was in his early 20s. Like, he did it in college and when he was in the Army as well. And then he gave it up, actually, when my mom became pregnant with me. And I didn't really know about that part of his life, like, when I went into radio. Like, I think it's like one of those things that had been mentioned, but it wasn't like a part of his identity that was ever discussed. And I have heard the recordings. And in fact, we did a story on a Father's Day episode where I played some of the recordings and talked to him about it. He's very smooth. And he's very much like, it's the 50s when he's doing this. Like, I'm old. And he's a DJ. He's a 1950s era DJ. And doing the ads and doing the news, and decent, a much better voice than mine, actually, and totally solid. For me, hearing the recordings, the thing about it that was emotional was hearing him do something that I know so well, and hearing him be so much younger than me doing it, and not as, I mean, I hope this isn't a hurtful thing to say, but like, not as good. You know what I mean? Like, hearing him read like really bad ad copy and having to perform it as if he's really saying the words and meaning it, and knowing exactly what that's like to have a script in front of you, but try to talk as if it's a thing you're really saying, and hearing him like sometimes really pulling it off, but sometimes not totally. I don't know. It's just like, it's a different way in on your own parents.
Your sister Randy has described you as a nosy introvert. And
yes, noisy.
Noisy.
But nosy is also true. Nosy is very much. Yeah.
No. I thought nosy was actually really cool, because that would make sense given your curiosity. But I misread it. It's noisy.
Noisy. No, like, but nosy is just as true, for sure. Very nosy introvert. Yes. Noisy introvert is this category that Randy came up with to describe herself. Where she could be very social, but actually she prefers to be alone. And then when she said it, I realized, like, oh, I have, it's like, a, so, I know so many people like that, especially, I think, writers. So many writers, I think, have the personality type of, like, they can manage in a social setting and they're okay for a couple of hours, but really where they'd rather be is alone. And that's a lot of my personality, too.
When my fiance Roxanne and I first got together, she's very quiet and can be very shy, and I'm not. And I would want to try to get more out of her really understand her emotionality and that inner dialogue. And I remember talking to my therapist about it and saying, you know, she's such a good writer and she talks so much about her emotions as she, while she's writing. And she very sort of abruptly said, that's why she's a writer.
Yeah.
So it really helped me understand the different ways that people prefer to communicate.
Yes. Yeah. Well, I'm very aware of those tendencies in myself.
You sound that like that is something that is concerning to you.
What a therapist-like response.
Couldn't help myself.
I understand the ways in which in public I'm able to do things that can be harder for me in a personal relationship, for sure.
You wanted to be both an astronaut and a magician when you were a kid.
Yes.
But both your parents grew up really poor, and they wanted you to be a doctor.
Yes. I wouldn't say poor, but they were like, they were people without a lot of spare money, for sure. Yeah.
I believe you were quite a talented amateur magician and became well known in your neighborhood for being able to make a very credible Snoopy out of balloons.
Yes. Yeah. No, I gigged as a kid magician when I was a teenager and did children's parties and did magic tricks. I have to say I'm like in terms of just sheer craft, I'm not very good.
Oh really? Because I was kind of hoping that maybe
I can totally do balloons still. Yeah.
Would
yeah.
you?
Yeah, totally.
Thank you. There's a variety of colors and...
Oh, wait, but these are...
No, those are the kind for balloons, for animals.
All right,
do you want me to hold the microphone?
Hold on, I'll put it down.
How good is this? Okay, let's just acknowledge that this is a classic radio moment.
These are not the right kind of... What you need are ones that are like long and thin, but...
Aren't those long and thin?
No, these are actually sort of stubby. You need like a 245 or a 260, which means 2 inches long and... 2 inches wide and 45 inches long, or 260s.
My point is made.
But I have my bag. If somebody could grab my bag from back there.
We did not plan this.
Like, I do carry around usually a couple of balloons because sometimes you're in a situation, a reporting situation, or just you're with a friend's kid and it's appropriate to pull out an animal balloon. I can make a coin disappear while we wait for the bag.
Really? I hear things happening back there. So can you still make a Snoopy?
That's my bag. I could make a Snoopy, yeah. Sure, for sure I could. Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay. Oh, my. This has been a weird afternoon.
I take that as a compliment. Oh, wow.
So, okay, Snoopy, not a poodle, but a Snoopy.
Yeah.
Okay, hold on.
Please, can someone tape this videotape?
Do you want to mic the sound of this?
It's funny, like, I don't buy these balloons very often. I can feel that this one's kind of old, so it actually might pop. So just a warning in advance. Now doing the body and the back legs. This is actually the part that's sort of every animal you make out of balloons. I learned this from a book called Roger's Rubber Ark. Okay. What up? Can you see it, Snoopy?
Oh, Snoopy. Snoopy, my very own Snoopy, made by Ira Glass. Wah, wah, wah.
You mean wah, 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 wah.
Let's do the rest of our interview like that. So the Peanuts Treasury was one of your favorite books growing up.
But yes.
You've stated that it defined the emotional climate of your elementary years.
Yes, yes. Yeah.
So
very
in what
much,
way?
I connected very strongly with Charlie Brown. And I think like one of the things... I mean, I've written about this, but like, I think one of the things that's interesting about Peanuts is that it was art that's for kids, and yet it's so movingly sad. And I, like a lot of kids and a lot of people who I've gotten to know as an adult, just connected to that sadness.
To the melancholy.
Yeah, yeah. And so, and it's funny, like, I don't remember ever laughing at Peanuts. Like, to me, it never seemed funny. It just seemed very real. And I remember my mom, I identified so strongly, I remember my mom saying to me, "You're not Charlie Brown." Yeah.
Did that surprise you?
That I wasn't Charlie Brown? It isn't how I saw myself. Like, I saw myself as very much like Charlie Brown. I had friends and stuff, but yeah, there's something about the aloneness of that character that I connected to.
How do you think Charlie Brown grew up?
That's a really interesting question. I don't know. I've never thought about that. Like, who would he be?
I think he would be Chris Ware.
Oh, it's so funny because I know Chris Ware. Chris Ware is this cartoonist who does these very melancholic comic strips and then became kind of an expert on Charles Schulz and has written about him. And in fact, has visited his house and met his widow. I know because I know Chris. And yeah, like Chris, but interestingly, like Chris, while he has the part of him that is very much connected to Charlie Brown and is just as melancholic as that. Have you met him? Have you interviewed him?
Yes.
Yeah, like I feel like actually in real life, he's so much better put together and more successful and, you know, just invented this aesthetic for doing comic stories, but just also, like, you know, is a completely successful, like, parent and husband and is just a functioning adult who is actually much sturdier, you know, very sturdy and happier, I think, than his public persona, though I think it would make him wince to hear me say that.
Yes, I think so.
Yeah.
You loved to put on plays and shows when you were a kid, and you made these plays with your siblings. I understand you knew every line and joke from the play The Fiddler on the Roof.
Yes. Yeah, my mom took us to plays when I was a kid. And it's funny, in retrospect, I only came to understand this, that... Like, I think that those old Broadway musicals, like, I grew up in the 60s and early 70s, and I didn't listen to rock music. Like, I listened to, like, the musicals, and those were the records that we had in the house. And my mom would take us to shows growing up in Baltimore County, and so there's a lot of Jews in Baltimore County, and so Fiddler on the Roof would come through, like, every year or two. And so I remember seeing it so many times as a kid, and then I stopped seeing it when I was 18. I hadn't, you know, just, like, didn't see it. I was a grown person. And then a couple of years ago, I went and saw a production on Broadway, not the Yiddish one that's up now, but there was one in English. And I went with a friend. And I realized I knew every single line before it was said. Like, people would come on with, like, tertiary roles, and I would know what they were going to say before they said it. I had seen it so many times, and it imprinted itself so hard. And I think, like, in retrospect, after I started making This American Life, like, there came a point where I realized that the aesthetics of Fiddler on the Roof, where, like, if you've seen it, like, it starts off as a comedy, and it's really about, you know, a father with these three girls and wants to get them married off, and there's the matchmaker who's going to fix them up, and they don't want her to fix her up with, like, the wrong person, and there's a whole, like, early scene where, like, he's going to promise his oldest daughter to the butcher, and he's very, very rich, so he wants that as a dad. But the butcher wants to marry his oldest daughter, but he thinks the butcher wants to buy his milk cow. And they have a conversation where they don't understand. You know, he thinks he wants to buy the milk cow, and the butcher wants to marry his daughter. So it's like a comedy at first, and then as it goes on, what it's about are two things. One, each of the daughters basically does something that is just different than the way the parents think it should be done. The first daughter, you know, does one thing and another thing. Finally, the third daughter wants to marry a non-Jew, and he has to disown her. So it's really about this thing that's so fundamentally profound about, like, really one of the most profound things about, like, what do you do as a parent when your children do something that you don't agree with or approve of? And the girls do it sort of increasingly extreme things. And then the other thing that it's about as it goes on is the Jews getting expelled from Russia and the pogroms and just being made into people who are in diaspora always. And but that structure of like pulling you in with comedy at the beginning, and then gradually it gets more and more serious, and in fact by the end is quite sad. Just that structure. I think that you know, when I was coming up in my 20s and working at NPR in Washington, and I was a production assistant and associate producer and all those kind of like support jobs doing stories and just trying to invent a way to do radio, I feel like once I understood the basics of how to do journalism, there was a feeling I was looking for in the stories that I wouldn't have named. Like, I didn't name to myself, but I was just like, I just wanted to feel like more. And at some point, I just started to make stories that had exactly the structure of Fedora on the Roof, where they would be kind of funny at the beginning and pull you in with like something very light, and then you get invested in the characters, and then it gets more and more serious and turns out to be about a bigger something. And obviously, this is like a structure lots of people use and lots of different sorts of storytelling. And while I was doing it, I don't think I had like a conscious thought that that's what I was doing. I was just like, I just have a drive to make journalism have this feeling that I know a piece of work can have. But in retrospect, I do think that's what it's about. It's about that feeling that I would get from those old musicals.
You cried throughout the entire revival when you saw it.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I've talked about this publicly. You're not just intuiting that from the look of my face. Yes. Yes, I did, for a couple of reasons. Like, one, it was my mom who would take me to those shows, and my mom died now, I don't know, 2003, 2004, like whatever. Now I can't even.
2003.
You know, thank you. You know, and just like the thought, I think she would be so pleased that I would have gone to Fiddler on the Roof on my own, you know, without her taking me. And also that just I would go, you know, I live in New York City now. Like, we moved our show to New York to do television years ago and then quit TV, and sort of we all stayed here. And so I go to tons and tons of shows. And I think that, you know, like when you're a parent, I think you just kind of throw a lot of stuff at your kids that you like, hoping that it would be meaningful to them. I think it would mean something to her that that thing that meant so much to her would mean so much to me. But that also, like, we've put on shows, you know, we've worked with some people who make musicals, with Bobby Lopez, who did Book of Mormon, and with Lin-Manuel Miranda before Hamilton.
Yeah.
You know, like, and just, you know, just that I've been in that world, I think would be very moving to my mom.
Your, the American Life producer Julie Snyder has said that you love performing on stage in a way that is sincere and mystifying. And I'm wondering if that all comes from that early experience of Fiddler.
Maybe. Like, there's something about like me, like the fact that I would just decide to go on stage. Just, I think that there's just something in me as a person. Like in other ways, there are other things in my personality that just seem like they don't combine with that. Like the fact that like I started doing magic on stage because literally like I knew nothing about it. I went to the Baltimore County Public Library on Liberty Road and took out books on magic. And I was just like, oh, I'm going to do that. And then just like took out ads in the Baltimore Jewish Times. Just like, okay, you know, like $5, you know, pay me $5 and I'll come do magic tricks at your kid's birthday. Like, I didn't know anybody who had done magic. Like, I just literally just, you know, at the age of 11, just was like, oh, I could do that. You know, and it's just a very similar impulse that got me my own radio show. It's sort of like, oh, I think I can do that. And so I think, so, yeah.
What was it about magic that was so intriguing to you? Was it going from sort of one state of reality to another?
I think all of us who came to love magic, the actual mechanics of it are just kind of cool. It's not in a way more sophisticated than that. And then the fact that it also was a way to be funny in front of a group of people, because I wasn't a very skilled magician, but I could hold a room of children. You know what I mean? Very confident about that. Like, I could be very, I could connect with them and I could tell a story and I could be very funny. And somehow I just felt like I would be able to do that. You know, like it combined a bunch of things that I liked, in the same way that doing the radio combines a bunch of things that I like. Like, I like interviewing people. You know, I just actually enjoy it. And I'm nosy, you know, like I like figuring things out, and I love the editing part of it. And like weirdly, the part of it that I like the least, and in fact, sort of, I feel like I can do it competently, but I've never been fond of it, is the actual performing on the radio part. It always feels to me like at that point, like I have a script, and if I perform the script perfectly, it'll sound like I'm talking, and no one, and like the plot points will hit properly, mm-hmm. and the thing will just feel effortless. But there's so many times where I don't, you know, but I feel like just tense, and I can feel that it just feels a little bit fake and a little bit off, and it doesn't hit quite as well. So it's sort of like one of those games you get into where if you do it perfectly, nobody notices, and it just sells. And then there's all these ways for it to go badly.
Have you always been this hard on yourself?
Well, I used to not be as skilled at it, and so it was harder. Like I was really not. It's funny, when I give speeches now, often I'll play things from, like, you know, not even the first or second year, like the eighth year I was doing radio, and it's horrible.
You've actually said that it took you longer than anyone you know in radio, and you know a lot of people in radio, to actually get to finally be good. It took you longer
yes.
than anyone
else. And I still,
else.
Since in the years since I've said that, I have still never met anybody who took like a decade to get decent. In fact, I feel so aware when we've hired like interns and production fellows on our show, like I wouldn't have been able to get an internship on my own show when I was in my 20s. Like I was not good enough.
Why do you think you kept persevering? What kept you trying for 8 years? That's a long time.
Yeah, I know. There's something about it that attracted me to it, and it did have to do with like the interviewing and the editing, like those parts. Like I wasn't I was a very awkward interviewer at first, but I could get material out of people. I could get people to say stuff, and I could figure stuff out about material, about people, and have emotional moments on tape with people in a way that was very exciting to me. And so I felt like I was able to get certain stuff on tape, even though I was so like stammery and awkward. And then on the editing part, just for whatever reason, from the moment I started working at NPR, as soon as they showed me how to use I knew how to use a reel-to-reel tape recorder before then. I was doing college radio. But as soon as I was like editing real interviews, like I just had an instinctive feeling for how to do it. And so there was a part of it that just came so easily and I felt so confident in. And that sort of carried the rest, that I just felt like, I just felt like this could go somewhere and I couldn't tell where. And I had nothing else I wanted to do. And I wasn't ambitious enough or didn't think enough of myself to want to be like a filmmaker or like a real writer. You know what I mean? Like I didn't have a good enough self-image to aspire to something like that. But the notion of like, being, I don't know, just quietly like doing my little stories and sitting in an edit room, like that seemed doable.
Has your self-image changed at all?
I mean, it's weird. The like a person's, in my experience, like it has for sure. But the like a bad self-image doesn't go away. In my experience, you just kind of like pile other things you learn about yourself on top of it. And so, like, of course, now I'm, like, enormously confident as, like, somebody making radio stories and running a business and all those things.
What but, aren't you confident about?
I mean, what am I not confident about? I mean, I'm often, like, having to think my way through delicate, you know, like, management things and dealing with people. But that's normal, I think, for anybody who's a boss of lots of people. But that always takes thought. And then, I don't know, I think I would have pictured, like having done so many shows and having done a show for so long, somehow it would change some essential part of my picture of myself at my core. And I don't think it has. Like, I don't know. Like, there's something where I still think, like, just don't think that much of it all. If that makes sense.
What's the it? You don't think that much of it all. Like, is that you or your work or the combination?
I mean, I would say like, no, I feel like the work speaks for itself. I feel very confident about the work, but it's like it, I'm not a person who was able to turn that into like building up like a sense of like, oh, I'm really awesome, you know? But I feel like that's okay. I feel like I don't think I need that. And people who do feel that way sometimes just seem ridiculous. Though I do know people who have like a healthy sense of like, you know, self-confidence and whatever.
I think those are the people that are really well-parented. Not that I want to make any assumptions about how you were parented.
Yeah.
But I do find that people that come from happier families tend to feel just okay about themselves. That is something I've never felt, ever. Never once a day in my life. So I'm really curious about how people get to that place.
Yeah. Do you think people can go from one to the other?
From the ping pong back and forth, or to evolve to a place where they feel better about themselves?
To evolve to a place where they feel better about themselves.
Oh, yes. Yes, I
do. Do you?
I definitely feel better than where I started, but where I started was particularly grim.
But do you feel like that old personality, oh my God, I'm totally blanking on the name of the writer, the super famous writer who says like, where she's talking about this, she talks about it, it's sort of like in a down moment, it's like a ghost that can tap you on the shoulder.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
And, yeah.
Absolutely.
You do feel that?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You too?
Oh, of course. Yeah.
What do you do when you feel like an interview isn't going well?
Oh, I do a million things. Oh my God, so many things.
Give me like two or three.
I mean, it's so situational. Like, I mean, there are different ways an interview can go badly, but the most common one is the person just is not in touch with their feelings and their feelings about the experience you're trying to get them to talk about. And then you just have to try to bait them into remembering what the experience was. And so one of the tricks to do it is to just say like, okay, so if I was in this situation, I think I would feel this. Like, what was this like for you? Like, sometimes you just have to suggest your way into it. What else? Like, a lot of it is so situational of trying to like nudge them on this point or that point or this point or that point.
You kill a lot of shows that you've killed from
a
what
I
understand.
Stories.
A lot of stories. But
yes.
Three quarters? Is that right?
We don't kill three quarters. Well, it depends on what stage you're talking about. Like we look into a lot of stuff and then don't go ahead with it because it's clear like it can't be done well, or the people aren't good talkers, or we won't be able to get the information we want. Like, that's a lot. But of the stuff that we actually start to produce, where people report things out and get interviews on tape and fly around, I would say we kill easily a fourth, and maybe it's more like a half.
And does that often involve the people that you feel like you can't get something from that aren't really self-reflective or...
Yes. Yeah. Like often when somebody pitches a story, we'll say back, this person has to be able to talk about this part of it in an interesting way. And if they can't, it might be a story, but it's not a radio story. Like, radio is so peculiarly dependent on the quotes, you know? Like you can make a story about that person, but it shouldn't be a radio story if they can't actually talk about it. And so, and you know... I mean, I've joked about this a lot on stage of just like, there's such a, you know, like there's just a class of people who something amazing happens to them and they can't talk about it. And I just feel like, you know, we can't, it's hard to make a story with them. One of the tricks we do often is if they have a significant other in their life, we'll go to that person. Because sometimes that person is like a wonderful talker, a partner or a brother or sister. And so sometimes you'll hear like you can introduce a second character to the story who can carry the emotion of it. And there's some really beautiful stories actually we've done that way where the main character isn't carrying the feeling of it. So they'll tell the plot and they'll be there on stage and you have a sense of them. But then somebody else will say, oh no, they were really feeling this and that.
You mentioned your interview with Marc Maron just a little while ago, and you talked about his ability to sit in front of a microphone in a way that had a lot of feeling and a lot of heart. And you go on to state that the easiest, most fulfilling, most intimate conversations of your day are the ones that happen in front of a microphone.
Well, many days. So, like, I have to say, like, in my personal life now, you know,
things have gone
regularly.
Better.
Yeah, in my personal life, of course, I'm having conversations that are as intimate as that.
You told Mark that he exposed himself more in the 10 minutes that you were on the air with him than you had exposed of yourself in a year. And I'm wondering if...
I said that during his podcast?
Yeah.
Wow. He did such a good job.
That was a wonderful interview. You really, you guys had a lot of fun together.
Yeah.
But I'm wondering, do you feel like you give more intimacy to the show than you do to others or have in the past?
I mean, my mom was a therapist, right? And my sisters and I used to joke about what her therapy sessions must be like how she would like turn on active listening. And we had a hand gesture that we did for active listening, which was like, I just put my hands around my ears and bob my head from side to side. And, you know, like in an hour long or 2 hour long radio interview in a, wherever it is, like it's easy to be really focused on another person with a goal. So that kind of intimacy, it's a situation that's set up for that kind of intimacy, you know, versus, you know, you come home and people have different needs from each other or just whatever. People come into like a home situation with whatever it is that they need and have to kind of collide and figure out, you know, what they're going to talk about and how they're going to talk about it. And, you know, like in a personal relationship, the things you're stressed out on are way more present than in an interview. You know, I feel like in a good day, if I see the person I love, like, yeah, it's just as intimate, of course. But that's pretty new or recent, lately, anyway. But I will say it's much easier in a radio situation, like it always was. And it's funny, like, I think that it was just always very much easier in a radio situation. And I had to learn it more in a personal situation.
How did you go about learning that?
Practice. Being told, like, no, not like that.
How has the idea of what an American life means changed in the 25 years you've been doing This American Life?
You mean has the show changed or how?
No, what an American life is? How do you feel like that has changed over the time that you've had the show?
I mean, I think that like as everyone hearing our voices knows, like it's just a much more divided country, you know. I don't know. I feel like everything I have to say about this is everything that everybody knows, that we live in a moment where every bit of reality is contested into two stories created by two different teams. You know, there's my team, which is the mainstream news team, and there's the right-wing media team, and each one has its own narrative of every single event and many cultural things as well. And I think that'll be with us for the rest of our lives.
How do you combat fake news now, or the notion of what fake news is?
I mean, it's been interesting trying to game out what would be valuable to do. And so we have a bunch of different strategies on our show. And sometimes we'll just do origin stories, like here's how this became an issue and here's how it became to be thought of that way. We'll do that sometimes. Another thing we'll do is sometimes we'll just feel like, oh, this is in the news, but people don't really, the emotional fact of it isn't out there. So for example, we did a show a couple months ago on the Remain in Mexico policy. And I feel like most informed news people know that like the Trump administration has done big changes in immigration policy. And especially in the last year, this thing that's nicknamed Remain in Mexico. But I think like because stories came out sort of individually, the emotional fact of what it means, which is over 50,000, really, depending how you count it, more like 70,000 people who are seeking asylum, who in previous years we would have let into the United States after a simple screening and said, if you want asylum, basically, okay, wait here, here's your court date, you know, show up in court on this date. They would have waited inside the United States, and now they're sent back across the border to Mexico. But what that's meant is tens of thousands of people right across the border in these what amount to refugee camps without any support from a governmental organization. So you have people living in tent camps, you have people getting kidnapped. And so we did a series of stories that start off at one of the tent camps, but also include somebody who met a reporter right after he was told, okay, go back to Mexico. And he told the reporter, the thing I'm really scared about is getting kidnapped. And then sure enough, within hours, he was kidnapped. And the reporter had recordings that she made with the guy's sister of the cartel negotiating for his release. And it was interesting. It was like, it's like McDonald's. It's like a volume business. Like, they start off asking, I can't remember if it was $15,000, and they just steadily realize, oh, this person doesn't got any money. So finally, I think they get him out for like under $1,000. But it takes days. And, you know, and also part of that were stories with the customs agents who are quitting over it, some of them, and who just feel like, oh, sending people back to Mexico is actually a violation of U.S. law because we're sending people back into the situation where they can be killed, kidnapped, tortured. And I feel like, again, all of these things are sort of in the news, but without the emotional weight that you can get to through a properly told narrative where you meet the people and you feel something for them. And so we'd do something like that, or we did that with them. We went to Hong Kong, where I feel like, again, a lot of people, you see protests in Hong Kong, but we actually like spend time and meet the people in the early 20s who are actually protesting, and they're talking very movingly about how they think, like, no, they're going to lose. Like, China is not going to give them what they want, but they feel like they have to be out there. And I just feel like there were things that weren't in the excellent news coverage that I was hearing on NPR and reading in the New York Times and Washington Post and other places. Like, there's just a place for narrative in some of those things to actually make something that we all hear about feel more real. And so you can have not just like an idea of it in your head, but you can feel a thing for actual people. I mean, this is very traditional sorts of journalism, but something that radio is particularly good for. And then what else do we do? Like, sometimes we'll just kind of notice a thought or a feeling or a mood or something that we feel like we want to respond to or capture or deal with. Sometimes we'll do something where we'll try to move to the level of fact. Like, one of the shows, we did these two shows that I feel very proud of. It didn't get much attention, but like, where early on in the Trump administration, you know, there's this fight about immigration policy where it's sort of like, does allowing in low-wage immigrants make for a better country or a worse country? And we're just like, okay, let's leave aside the national debate. Let's just go to one town that got a ton of people coming in and look at how it affect this town. And we chose a town. Jeff Sessions was the president, had been like the sort of the spokesman for the anti-immigration political force before President Trump, and then was his, obviously, like one of the top people in his administration making it happen, along with Stephen Miller, of course. And we thought, like, why does Jeff Sessions believe this? And Jeff Sessions would talk about these towns in Alabama where people would come in from Mexico to work in the chicken plants, the chicken processing plants. And we're like, great, let's go to the number one town like that. So we found a town which had been a completely all-white town, totally, you know, 98% white. And then over the course of like a very fast period, became, depending on how you measure the numbers, either a third or a fourth Latino. And we're just like, what did it do to this town? Did it drive down wages? What did it do to people's taxes? What did it do to schools? What did it do to, you just like all the things people talk about, and hired economists to do a study of what did it do to people's wages? You know, and just try to answer it in this one place. And I feel like being able to take this sort of like national fight and turn it into like let's go to a place where we can actually measure and say like kind of yes or no, that seems like something nobody's doing. Or people do, but like it's hard to do. It took months. And we do it. I'm sorry, that was such a long answer. I'm so sorry. Well, examples.
I know, it's wonderful. I was actually sitting here trying to make one of those split decisions. Do I continue with this?
I know that decision so well. Yeah. I mean, like, if I were you, the follow-up would be right on the top. You see, but I feel like I've laid out all this data. So for me as an interviewer, the next move would be to be like, well, what's the idea that comes out of that? Like, what's your theory that comes out of that? Like, well, does it work? Ask me if it works.
No, I don't know. I know it doesn't.
Okay.
But what do you think?
It doesn't.
Why not?
Or I don't know. It works to the degree like something like that works. I feel like we're in a situation where, like, weirdly, podcasts, I feel like, are a little less coded as product of the mainstream media. I feel like we have a lot of conservative listeners. I feel like it's weirdly like being on NPR feels very much coded as being part of the liberal media, but being a podcast, and lots of people don't know us as an NPR show. They just know us as a podcast. In fact, right now, our podcast audience is something like 3.1 million people a week, and our radio audience is 2.2 million. We're a bigger podcast than we are a radio show. Because of that, I feel like we slip under the radar in a certain way with a certain number of people. I remember when Zoe Chace was doing back in the lead up to the last presidential election, Zoe Chace, one of our producers, did a ton of reporting on people in the Republican Party who loved President Trump, and people in the party who were just noticing the changes in the party and not feeling great about it, but also people who were feeling great about it. And when she went to the Deplorable Ball in Washington, the self-named Deplorables, who sort of claimed that they trolled the president into office, you know, somebody came over to her being like, "Oh, I love your coverage," you know. And I feel like there's a certain number of people who, you know, who don't identify us as part of or I don't know, it's
the East Coast liberal elite.
I don't even know what I'm talking about, but it seems like in some ways, sometimes we fly under the radar that way.
Do your radio listeners
some small degree?
Well, do the radio listeners respond and engage with you and the show in a different way than the podcast listeners?
No, I don't know. No, I can't tell who's who.
It would be interesting.
The radio listeners are as a group older, because the public radio audience tends to be older than the podcast audience. But I don't have anything smart to say about that.
This American Life won a Peabody Award in the very first year of broadcasting, which is really remarkable. You've won every major award there is to win in radio. You have won another award here today. Yeah, you've stated the following, Ira, and I was really curious about this, and this gets back to what we were talking about a little bit before about self-esteem, but this is really about the show. And you've said, honestly, making radio is still hard. I have really hard weeks on the show where I'm really frightened and really struggling to make the show good.
Yes.
And in a recent interview in The Guardian, you stated that you feel scared all the time.
Well, feeling scared all the time is normal for a broadcaster, right?
No.
Really?
I don't think so. I mean, maybe they're just not being honest with me, but not every broadcaster I know is scared all the time.
But like, you don't know if the thing's going to be any good. It's like being in the middle of like preparing a thing that's like not done, and you don't know if you're going to finish it on time, and you don't have enough time, and you're like, for me, fear is just built into making things.
But what about your track record? Do you feel like there's...
I feel confident we'll get it done as well as it can be done by us. You know what I mean?
If that's what keeps you as good as you are, like, then so be it.
Keith Moon once, the drummer of The Who once said, like, "I am the greatest Keith Moon style drummer in the world." I feel like that's so exactly how I feel. Like, I feel like I'm leaving here to go to work.
Like, you love that, though. That's not.
I do not love that, but we have a pledge. No, but we have a pledge drive to get it. I'm on a deadline. Like, we have a new show next week, but also it would be good if we got a pledge show out this week rather than waiting a week. And so, like, it's 5:30, 6 o'clock on a Sunday night. I'm going to leave here and then go work on the pledge show.
So, and how will you feel while you're working on it? Will you be wishing you were somewhere else? Will you be happy that you're there?
I will be absolutely wishing I was not there. Yeah, like I would much rather.
Where would you rather be?
I would rather be with my girlfriend getting dinner and hanging out.
How is it been back in the dating world?
It's been much better than being in an unhappy marriage where we were trying to make it work and trying our best and not succeeding.
How has that changed your worldview now, being in this different kind of relationship?
I mean, I just feel younger. I feel like better in general because of it.
I want to talk a little bit about Serial. Your podcast, Serial, not The Breakfast, which debuted in 2015, is the single most popular podcast ever made.
Yes.
It has been downloaded over 400 million times, and it established an ongoing podcast world record. It also has won every major award for broadcasting, including the Edward R. Murrow and the first ever Peabody for a podcast. Is it true that you didn't think you were starting anything big with Serial?
Yes.
How come? What was...
This is basically an idea that Sarah Koenig, the host, and Julie Snyder, the producer, who was the longtime senior producer of This American Life, like the way they saw it was, like, I think it's like, it's weird that this is like, that this is just 5 years ago, but this was such a new idea. The idea of like, we didn't know if you could tell a true story for more than one episode and people would come back and hear the next episode. Like, part of it was, could we make a story that's reporting, but instead of finishing it in 60 minutes, like, try to get people to come back next week and the week after and the week after, which is why so much of it is built with the structure of TV, because Julie loves TV and really understands TV, and she's like, let's build it like TV and structure out the story and the episodes and the hooks that pull you forward in the way that you would do for TV, and see if you can get people to listen to a piece of investigative journalism in the same way. And so that was so new. Like, honestly, we were just like, well, let's just try this. And I remember when they were working on it, Julie and Sarah would just say, like, well, who would be at some, like, decision point in the thing? And they would just say, like, well, who cares? Nobody's going to hear this thing. Like, and our business goal was to make back enough, basically to get a large enough audience so that the advertising that, you know, the underwriting that we could sell on it would cover the cost of it, which I think was $300,000.
MailChimp got a really good bargain.
They did.
That first season.
They did.
Ira Glass, you have done more to create this industry than anybody in the world. I know you hate that kind of stuff, okay, but it needs to be said. And I just want to thank you for making this all possible for all of us that have tried to follow in your footsteps. Ladies and gentlemen, Ira Glass.
Thanks for the nice interview.
If you love this podcast, please consider contributing to our brand new Patreon community. Members get early access to the podcast, transcripts of every interview, invitations to live shows, Q&A sessions with guests, and a brand new annual magazine. You can learn more about this at patreon.com/Debbie Millman. If you subscribe to this podcast through Apple Podcasts, please write a review or link to the podcast on social media. Design Matters is produced by Curtis Fox Productions. The show is recorded at the School of Visual Arts Masters in Branding program in New York City, the first and longest running branding program in the world. The editor-in-chief of Design Matters Media is Zachary Pettit, and the art director is Emily Weiland.